Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're very glad to have you listening. We're also very pleased to have here back in the studio with us once again, Dennis Barron. He is professor of English at the University of Illinois, and occasionally is here on the program to talk about language. We are here to, and when I say we, I mean he, is here to answer questions about grammar. We have talked on and off about language and how it changes, sometimes not always in ways that we feel comfortable with, but it changes nonetheless.
It does.
And that's fine. If you would like to complain about misuse, I can't promise you that there will be vindication, but you certainly are welcome to complain.
You know, we don't always have to get complaints. People could call in with their, what would be the opposite of a complaint? Their praise. Has English given you good service lately? Has there been a particular word that you would like to recommend for, you know, employee of the month? They get a special parking space in the dictionary. I don't know, something like that. It doesn't always have to be bad news, David.
I'm pleased to see you so positive this morning. Any and all of this, the numbers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think at this time of year, we often talk about the word of the year.
The word of the year. Well, I'll tell you what the word of the year is. It's snow.
No, snow. That's not.
Yeah.
That may be the word of the day.
You've heard the myth that Eskimo has 23 different words for snow. It is, and it is a myth. I shoveled every one of those 23 different kinds of snow this morning before
sure
I got here.
I had many other colorful words maybe that we could not be using on the radio.
Very synonyms for snow that you never knew had any association with snow.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second, but I do want to talk about the word of the year. What I have found, this is the one that's the American Dialect Association, is that right?
Yeah, American Dialect Society.
The word is subprime.
Subprime. That's right.
And I think it's interesting, and we've talked about this before, it does seem in some small way to be an indicator of what it is we're thinking about it at that time.
Right.
I remember the time that the word of the year was IED. It was for improvised explosive device.
Yeah, that was my word of the year.
Oh, that was just
their word of the year last year, to give you a comparison between my word of the year, which was actually roadside bomb. Their word of the year was plutoed.
Plutoed, yes.
Plutoed, which means to have happened to you what happened to the planet formerly known as Pluto.
To be downgraded?
Which got downgraded.
Yeah.
You know, it was acting way above its pay scale. and so there was a course correction, and Pluto was...
Plutoed.
Sacked.
Yeah,
it was plutoed.
Quite
yeah.
Nice
demoted. Yeah. Defrocked. Yeah. Deplaneted.
Well,
that word is a word that's going nowhere. No. And subprime, well, you know, it has a particular meaning at a particular time. But it too, I mean, the question is this going to, does this word have legs? I think I'm mixing a lot of metaphors this morning. If you shovel snow for an hour and a half, you know, I find that you can't think very clearly. But... Does subprime, I mean, are we going to see spinoffs of subprime? Are we going to walk around saying, you know, I feel kind of subprime today?
I like that. I'm going to use that.
You're going to use that? Okay. Yeah. Okay, let's see if we can do for subprime
Harriet
what Stephen Colbert, Stephen Colbert did with truthiness.
What are
we going to do
okay.
with subprime?
Subprime. I'm feeling subprime today. No, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. They'll get really tired of that.
You go into the doctor's office, they say, you know, well, what seems to be, I'm feeling kind of subprime.
They got a pill for that, I'm sure.
They do.
Is the idea behind this the idea that that word will indeed have legs, or is it just that
it's
frequently
there's many
used.
Ideas behind it, okay? So ideally, a word captures the spirit of the times. Hmm. It somehow evokes, like, you know, like the Time Magazine Person of the Year and the, you know, the great the picture of the year, and all, you know, all the blank of the year, things that we look back on at the end of the year and say, boy, that was a big deal this year. Yeah, subprime was a big deal this year. Plutoed,
Yeah, no.
Not so big. Not so big. Even the astronomers, I think, you know, they did it and they said, let's move on.
I don't even think that, you know, when I remember having talked about this, I don't recall having ever heard Plutoed before they decided that was
I never heard it before
the, of the year.
The only time I heard it after is when I would talk about it and say how ridiculous it was.
All right. Well, some words they go lay live. Or are there any thing that stand out to you as?
Hey, one of the words of the year a few years ago was blog, and that's still around.
Oh, okay. Well, I remember one. I actually remember one time we were talking about that as if, of course, everyone should know what that was. And then I think someone called in and said,
people didn't know. Yeah.
Blog. What's a blog?
Yeah, yeah.
There are maybe still people who don't. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I've got a blog now.
Do you have a blog?
I have a blog. Yeah. I've been blogging for over a year. The Web of Language.
Huh.
Google it.
All right.
You'll love it.
We have several callers here.
If you think I'm bad on the air, you should read this.
You should
this
read
stuff.
The guy's blog. All right.
And it's got pictures.
Even better. Some of your drawings or
no, no, pictures? It's stuff I you know, steal off the web.
To say swipe.
Swipe off the web like in violation of copyright, I'm sure.
All right. Well, here we go.
As long as the record producers don't get wind of me, I'm okay.
We'll talk here with some people who are listening, and we'll start with line number one right here. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I would be interested in hearing Professor Barron talk about the word cool.
Cool.
And its many uses. I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
Hasn't that not been with us for, well, I think about that going back to the time of the Beats.
Yeah.
But maybe that's even a word that's older than that.
I think it's probably a little older than that. I don't remember the exact date, but at least goes back to the 50s, perhaps into the 40s. The 50s, I think the initial association was with cool jazz as the jazz genre, subgenre, the subprime version of jazz that followed hot jazz of the 30s, the post-bebop. Probably kind of thing. Some jazz aficionado will probably call in and narrow that down
and
for
say
us.
Your jazz history is subprime.
Yeah, yeah. And it, interestingly, as a slang term or as an informal English term, it has not gone out of fashion. I mean, it goes out of fashion a little bit, but it keeps coming back. So kids today are saying cool as if they had invented it. And when, of course, we did, or our parents did, or their parents did, or somebody
like
back there
invented it
and put it, you know, they used it for a while, put it in the back of their closet, took it out again when it came back in fashion. Don't give cool back, you know, to the thrift shop because it's coming back.
It does surprise me from time to time.
It's a word that has legs.
Know, to hear the young people still using, I guess I like the idea that they're still using that word.
And yeah.
They're not, if you say, you know, you're a 50-year-old guy, if you say cool, nobody's going to look at you like, you know, you're some kind of fossil. You know, cool is still.
But they look at you and think, oh, you know, they're trying to be younger than they are. Can old people like me say cool anymore, even though, you know, when I was 13, cool was already, you know, trite.
When you were 13, cool was already trite?
Well, we were very avant-garde.
Well, I hope that is...
Pretentious, so, I think the word was.
So cool, you think that cool will stay with
cool.
us?
It seems to be pretty long-lived. It's going to, you know, it'll go in and out of fashion, but I don't think it'll be out of fashion too long. There's a place for it, I guess. We feel a need for a word. It's a cool word.
Cool.
Cool.
All right.
Cool.
Let's talk with somebody else. Champagne. This is line two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about, you know how the dictionaries now have, and they have for a long time, abbreviations.
Mm.
What the abbreviations were. So the other night I was watching TV and there was a commercial that was all written in text message.
Oh, that commercial and text message. Yeah, my students talk about it a lot.
So do we see a time when text message words, how else to describe them, will be in the dictionary? And I'd like you just to talk about that, and I'll hang up.
All right.
Well, will they be in a dictionary? I don't know. I suppose that's possible. In a dictionary, it's possible. We always have used abbreviations, acronyms, a variety of ways of shortcutting the language, certainly in the written form. Goes back to old manuscript tradition in the Middle Ages and the classical world before that, just because to save paper, to save labor. And also, I think in the earlier forms of writing, a lot of people were writing down things that they already knew. So the writing was a reminder rather than coming to something new. Mm-hmm. So when you write notes to yourself, still you abbreviate because you sort of are looking at it to jog your memory rather than to record the entire text. Sometimes, so that's it's an old thing. It goes way back in a number of languages. What's the status of it today? This is the big fear among some people, is that the kids today who text message, these young whippersnappers who IM and text, where a lot of these abbreviations abound, that it's going to leak out of those domains and enter the language at large as a kind of contaminant. I mean, most people fear contamination, that it is, it's sort of like a linguistic prion that we won't be able to get rid of. So, and I even hear, I was in the English building last spring and heard some students walking down the hallway, and one of them was talking on the cell phone and saying, OMG, OMG, which is a text message abbreviation. David, you look puzzled.
I am puzzled.
For those of you who can't see David, you're something wrong with your television set. He's looking puzzled. OMG is the text or IM abbreviation for oh my God.
I see. This was, in fact, something that I had on my list to ask whether to what extent or whether, in fact, the abbreviations that are used. And the reason that people do that is because they get charged by the letter, so you want to do it in as few letters as possible, whether that was actually creeping out, whether – I guess the thing that I was thinking –
Well, they don't actually get charged by the letter, but text messages are limited to – and the number was 132 characters in a text message, including spaces – something like that. And so there's some pressure to do it. But apparently my students tell me, and I don't know a lot about the technology of texting, that if you exceed that, your service or some services anyway will simply separate it into two texts and send them sequentially.
Well, it shows you what I know. Somehow thought it was the longer it was, the more it costs to...
No. No, it's not like a telegram. In the old days, telegrams. We used to do this with telegrams. Nobody here probably, maybe a couple of our listeners remember sending or receiving telegrams back in the day. But I don't know. Telegrams haven't really been in much use since the 60s or 70s. But you paid by the word. There was a basic charge for, a minimum number of words. And then beyond that, you paid by the word. And so there was a kind of telegraphic language, which was sort of a shorthand, leaving out unnecessary words. I don't know so much if there were abbreviations as there were sort of leaving out words here and there. And so it was kind of truncated language.
Yeah. In a sense, I was like, expect arrive Monday.
Something like that.
So if you in a text message, if you are using the fewest number of letters to spell a particular word or maybe even a phrase the fewest numbers of letters that will convey the meaning or perhaps it's a commonly agreed upon collection of letters that designate something. Is that truly an abbreviation or is there another word for that?
Well, I don't know. I would call it an abbreviation or a truncation. The acronyms are when you is something like OMG, which is where a letter of each word, and then it spells it out. But I call it a contraction. Okay. Now the other thing is that these went on with instant messaging before text messaging came on the scene. And so there, in instant messaging, it was just a convention. There was no real limit in terms of space as much. The convention was short, succinct messages full of these things and the little pictures that came to be called emoticons.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the example that shows that something like that could actually go from text form to speech.
Oh, yeah.
That someone would actually...
Is it going to do it on a large scale? No.
No.
It's not. Is it going to start appearing in students' more formal writing? a little bit, but not on a large scale. Again, just as, you know, occasionally if you're writing something in a hurry, even if it's formal, you'll put in an ampersand instead of writing at and.
Yeah. But you don't even, would you expect in print, but in things, perhaps things like advertising, would you be surprised to see?
I wouldn't be surprised to see it in advertising, which takes very often a playful approach to language. And certainly we've got novels written as emails, novels written as text messages, novels written as instant message exchanges. And so there you'll see it. But there it's simply an attempt to capture the style, to evoke the genre of the text message.
Well, I suppose we've got novels that are written in form of letters, so why not?
Exactly. It is the postmodern version of the epistolary novel.
Yeah, exactly. You know, extra points for you in the audience.
Samuel
Richardson, what epistolary means.
Epistolary means novels that are written as letters. You know,
all right. We have several callers here. Dennis Barron is our guest. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. And occasionally he's here. We talk about language.
Yeah, and you know, us talking about text messages like the blind talking to the people who wear very, very thick glasses. Because I know nothing, really, when it comes down to that. I mean, I see people whose thumbs are so agile in text messaging that they don't even look on the screen. My students tell me, and this is scary, that they text while they drive.
That is scary. That's even
it's worse than talking
on the
phone.
That's bad enough.
Because
texting while you drive, and then the keyboard. The keys are so tiny.
The keys are tiny.
What's an old guy like us to do? We're just not going to do it.
Get with the program. Get a BlackBerry.
Okay. With real big buttons.
Yeah, get a BlackBerry.
The old guy's BlackBerry is the size of a typewriter.
Right, you know, like these giant remote controls they sell.
Right.
What is that for, so you don't lose it in the couch?
That's right. Okay. Let's talk with some more folks here and talk to somebody in Spring Bay. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning. to go along with the subprime, another one I think is fun is collateralized debt obligation.
Collateralized debt obligation. I don't even know what that means. I mean, I'll have to call my broker and ask him.
It's debt obligations that are collateralized with homes, I think, basically.
It's like a second mortgage.
We used to call it mortgage, yeah. Second mortgage.
And then to mix it up a little bit, I think those collateralized debt obligations have recently received a little collateral damage.
Yes.
And contributing to part of the meltdown, I think. But it's the political season, and I've been listening to lots of politicians talk, and the cliches are always fun. But the one that's really started to show up is so many people are saying, the fact of the matter is, and my eyes just glaze over when I hear I guess maybe it would be good to send the politicians off to some kind of class on, you know, getting to the point.
An eye deglazing class.
So I'll hang up and listen. Yeah. I'm enjoying your conversation.
Yeah. Right. So eye deglazing lessons. The fact of the matter is, I don't know, that one's not so bad, I suppose, but it's... you want politicians who speak directly and who are rhetorically eloquent and... stuff like that, and I don't know. It tends not to come with the job description. There aren't too many. There aren't too many. I mean, we've got, I think, maybe a slightly better crop this season than ever before, than I can remember, and that's why everybody's sort of evoking Kennedy and Camelot and stuff like that. Because there's a little bit better rhetoric going around. But yeah, politicians have, politician is a synonym for evasive.
Well, perhaps what it is the caller's thinking about is if someone tells you something, prefaces their remarks by saying the fact of the matter is, it's as if they're saying, I'm going to deliver unto you the truth.
Yeah.
And of course, we all know it's just.
Not the truth, but it'll take me a very long time to tell you about it.
All right. Let's go on here. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana. No, we were going to, but they gave up on us. Line 2 in Champaign.
They had to go out and shovel.
Yes. Hello. Line 2, Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I had a question, but let me first qualify what I'm going to say, and that is I absolutely believe in language change and the fact that we, you know, we're not frozen in any particular kind of usage.
Yes, I hear the but coming here. But.
More and more on the local news, and I'm trying to decide whether this is a shift into, if this is becoming part of standard American English. It's the usage of has went or must have gave or...
Okay.
Sort of all went down. I kind of kept track on Channel 3 of the number of times I've heard this used by various reporters, and I'm just wondering, is this becoming part of our American edited English or whatever it's called these days?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think this is just an indication of, you know, who's getting hired to read the local news.
So it's...
I don't see this breaking out of the Central Illinois market actually with that. I think it is probably a pretty regional.
It is regional. Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I just didn't know whether I hear it so often that I'm beginning to think it should be or it appears to be part of standard usage.
Has went. I know. I I have to confess not watching.
Local
news, which is, you know, I get my news from NPR and I'm proud of it. So
I've even heard it on NPR
well,
a couple of times.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay, so it's not yet part of.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I would just, you know, think of it as a localism.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you for the call. Something like that.
And then it could also be occasionally... just a speech error, because when you're speaking extemporaneously, it's easy to make those kinds of agreement errors.
Yeah. So the question would be, is the person making it, do they think that that's correct? Well, one question would be, do they think that's correct or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Probably they do or they don't. I don't know.
When does the point come when enough people
most
say
of
it?
Most of us
think
we make mistakes, but when challenged, we think we're correct. So,
yeah, yeah.
So that, I mean, that's why I'm dithering on that. It's not just because I didn't observe it or didn't have a chance to ask the person, but we have an ambivalent sense of our own speech production. We like to think we try to be correct. We know that we make mistakes. We know that certainly in speech, it's easier to. Speech is more tolerant of mistakes. There are more opportunities for repair. You can go back and repeat and correct it, or even if you say it wrong and you don't hear it and your audience either does or doesn't notice it, speech goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little harder. Writing is a little harder on that kind of correctness issue than speech. And it depends, you know, conversation is one thing. Talking on the air is another, and whether it's is this person reading or are they speaking extemporaneously?
Yeah. Well, when we all get implanted with those chips, we can
the
put
chips.
In a grammar checker.
Is there going to be a salt-free chip?
If you like,
low fat.
Yeah, absolutely. High fiber.
Grammar checker.
The
first thing on your word processor to turn off is the grammar checker. Those things
seriously?
Are crazy.
Oh, okay. I generally don't pay that much attention to it. Spelling, all right, I'm a terrible speller.
Yes.
But spell check, that's good. Grammar check, I most of the time I don't, it tells me something's, it says, are you sure about this? And I'm thinking, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, yeah. They give you information that you don't know how to decode, so just turn it off.
All right. Dennis Barron, ladies and gentlemen, professor of English at the University of Illinois, he says, turn off your grammar checker.
Turn off your grammar checker. You know, Microsoft's buying Yahoo today. They don't care whether or not you use the grammar checker.
That's right. All right, just so you got the word. Line 3 is next. The caller's in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I was going back to the instant messaging. I was going to suggest that we could return to some of the medieval conventions. We could eliminate spaces.
Mm-hmm.
If a word ends with the same letter that the next word begins with, you eliminate one letter.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose not having capitals wouldn't help with a...
We could do away
message.
With the capitals, but the other thing we could do is, you know, put lines over minims and do something about all of those nasals.
Yeah, that's true. Could even invent another symbol for the TH symbol. We'd need two of them in English, but...
Mm-hmm.
not just a few idle.
Hey, I got an even better idea. Let's drop out the vowels.
Why not? Lots of several languages do very nicely without it.
Exactly, exactly. And if that works, we can leave out the consonants, too.
And you know something? It wouldn't be any less intelligible than it is now.
It is more bizarre. I mean, to me, if you want to look in that kind of framework,
mm-hmm.
to use a telephone to write with altogether,
yeah.
then to look at the kind of writing that you do on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I may be old-fashioned, but I thought they were for talking.
Well, that was my...
The name seems to imply, you know, talking over distance.
And my aging fingers just won't deal with
it. Won't deal with it. No. I know. I still can't do the thing where you type with both thumbs because I have to hold the phone in one with one hand and type with the other thumb on the other hand.
God knows how kids driving a car do this, so I guess it's better not to speculate.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm enjoying
that. Thank you. That does, yes, that does, the idea of texting while you're driving, that really does kind of scare
me. Yeah, I think it's not in the motor vehicle code yet, but, you know, TWD is like the next.
Texting while driving.
Yeah, I got a TWD. I got to go to traffic school.
The caller was pointing to the fact, I gather, that in the Middle Ages, because paper was very expensive, was that really what...
They didn't even use paper. They were using dried animal skins.
That would be vellum?
Parchment vellum. Yeah.
So what you were trying to do was...
Paper comes in later, really, with the age
of as close to, you know, you don't want to have spaces. You want to use the fewest number of characters.
Well, here's my argument with that. In a lot of the early writing systems, we see this sort of space-saving, labor-saving devices. And I think that is partly because, and there's a number of factors, partly because a lot of early writers had to prepare their own writing materials. They had to prepare the vellum or the parchment. They had to prepare the stone or clay surface. Certainly they had to prepare their writing instruments, the styli, the quill pens. They had to prepare the inks that they used, grinding powders, mixing them with liquids to do. I mean, this is very labor-intensive stuff. Or if you know, there was no medieval Staples where you went out and, you know, I'll take a ream of
vellum
and a couple of number two quill pens. You couldn't do that. So even if you bought them from a stationer, they were not cheap. And so there was some, interest in maximally covering the surface once you had it with as many letters as you could. And the other thing, even when you were writing for artistic purposes and surface coverage wasn't, you know, the only thing your patron was willing to pay for multiple sheets of vellum and lots of fancy paints and inks and gold leaf and stuff like that to illuminate your manuscript with, there was still the notion that you were writing something, a text that the reader was already fairly familiar with. And so you could abbreviate in order to, just save the effort of copying the manuscript. And they would sort of, you know, expand the abbreviation when they saw it, because they knew what the word was going to be anyway.
Other than Hebrew, I think that's one, mm-hmm. where in the written form,
right,
there are no vowels.
Right.
Are there many others?
Okay, so that depends on what kind of writing system you're using, because if you're using an alphabetic kind of writing system, then there are vowels and consonants that you record. But if you're using a syllabary, which is one symbol per syllable rather than per phonetic sound in the language, the symbols and syllabaries typically combine vowels and consonants together in one symbol. And if you're using a charactery, like Chinese, a character-based system, then each character stands for a word or a concept, or at least a morpheme, and a word-building unit in the word. And it will include typically some phonetic information, but not a whole lot in many cases. So you know, the big contribution that the Greeks were supposed to have made to writing was that they took a Phoenician writing system, Phoenician syllabary, which didn't specify vowels, and they added, and they adapted it to the Greek language, and they added symbols for the vowels because there were some symbols left over in the syllabary, and so they said, well, we'll make these symbols stand for the Greek vowel sounds. And was this a revolution or just, you know, I think it was just a little tinkering with the system.
And the Phoenicians got no credit, did they?
Well, they got some credit, but they still get no respect.
Dennis Barron is here with us. He's professor of English at University of Illinois.
I don't mean to insult any Phoenicians out there.
I don't think there are any left. Are
oh.
There? I think they're gone.
Oh.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
I think.
Sorry.
All right. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. Occasionally he's here. We talk about language. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller's in Vermilion County on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have become increasingly aware in about the last 10 or 15 years of usage on the air that I wonder if it is considered acceptable as informal speech or if it's just misuse of the words. Gone missing or went missing.
Mm.
And busted down the door, thieves busted in, something like that. Busted strikes me as an incredibly uncomfortable word for me. I wonder about the others.
Gone missing, went missing. Yeah, I guess I've heard that one perhaps more and more. I don't know. It's not something I'd been tracking, but it certainly sounds familiar.
It seems to me that is that not a convention of British English?
It seems vaguely British to me.
Although why now we should start using it, I don't know.
We borrow things. We imitate British speech, you know. Even though the Beatles aren't together anymore, right? They've gone the way of the Phoenicians.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. But I got to get
well,
out
all
more.
Except for Ringo.
Except for Ringo.
Ringo, he's still out there.
Yeah.
He actually has a new well, now they call them CDs. When I was a kid,
records.
We called them records. I still do.
I think they call CDs records now.
Do they really?
I don't know.
Okay, anyway, the caller's gotten disgusted and hung up. And maybe we should get back to her. Question.
I don't see anything.
So you have
wrong
any problem with gone
with,
missing?
I don't have to see anything wrong with it. Actually,
all right. What about busted
down
busted?
The door?
Busted down
know.
The door.
It just sounds like a sort of colorful expression.
Seems then to me that's more of a slang term, perhaps.
Yeah, it sounds slangy. It sounds, you know, evokes the sort of thing you might see on Law and Order, you know.
So if a student, one of your students in a paper wrote, included the word busted as in busted down the door, would you take out your red pen and
I don't
mark
have
that
a
up?
Red pen.
What do you, what, how, in what manner do you correct?
Well, lately I've been just adding comments in the margins on Microsoft Word.
So do the, your
I students
the submit
students
things
email,
in that?
Email their papers to me. And I just comment them on them directly and in the margins and at the end and email them back.
Do they ever take form as hard copy?
Rarely. Rarely. I mean, partly I do this, you know, to save paper and printing costs for the students. But also, I find it much easier to read and respond to the papers on the screen than to, I mean, you see a stack of papers sitting there on your desk. And you look for reasons not to have to delve into them. But cleaning out my inbox is something I do all the time. And so every time I get an email with a paper, I open it, I read the attachment, comment on it, send it back. It seems easier psychologically. But it's probably just me. You know, mm-hmm. It's idiosyncratic.
Very interesting.
Could be the wave of the future.
Could be.
Could be.
All right. Unless you're a Phoenician.
Do they read the comments more? I have no idea. I need to get some feedback on that. I always had the feeling that if the grade was satisfactory, they didn't read the comments, many of them. And if it was unsatisfactory, probably many of them didn't read the comments either.
Do you think that you comment at greater length
I
than
do.
You would if you would you were having to write this down yourself?
I do. I've noticed that I comment at greater length But I also think that I comment a little bit more directly, and sometimes I worry that I'm hurting them, their feelings, and I'm being a little too blunt.
And is that a nature of the... I know that, for example,
people
said...
It's the nature of the beast with emails.
Yes. It's easier to be blunt.
So I think after our, you know, after the first couple of semesters when I did this, I sort of settled back into the teacherly mode of how can you convey this message without you know, upsetting or alienating the student, but so that they can improve their writing thereby.
And they may not be reading it anyway.
And they might not be reading it anyway, so why bother?
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
A phrase that is common around Urbana, that also in Indiana, is when people say, I seen so-and-so, or I seen that, rather than I have seen, or I saw.
Yeah.
Is that common to just here in the Midwest?
I think it's common everywhere as a certain kind of, I don't know that it's necessarily regional so much as one kind of dialect variation that we associate with perhaps social class.
So it's considered grammatically correct or okay?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's not particularly standard English, but it's certainly a variety of English that's not new or unfamiliar, which is not to say that it's stigmatized. I mean, people who don't use that variety will say, this may be an uneducated speaker or someone who's incorrect or making mistakes.
It just sounds
simple folk or something like that, you know, some negative attribute that you might ascribe to the speaker.
Well, it's interesting to me that I grew up in a family of six children and only two out of the six use that phrasing, but it may be related to families that they married into.
Ah, okay. Okay, I'm but not going there because, you know.
Well, it's just, like you say, it's what you grow up listening to or what the people in your environment use.
Yeah, we pick up the language.
It has nothing to do with intelligence or anything of that nature.
Not at all. Not at all. It's just...
Okay.
It's in the air. It's in the environment. It's in the water.
Yep.
All right.
Okay,
thank you. Well, I suppose that doesn't necessarily mean, though, or it would be interesting to know, for example, would you, if you'd use that construction, if you were just talking with someone in your family, say, well, I seen it already.
Okay.
But
then
if you were talking with a stranger.
People code switch.
Would you do that? Or if you were, would you say, well, I would never, if I was writing.
Yeah,
I wouldn't do that.
A lot of it depends on our own sense of linguistic awareness, because a lot of us code switch automatically. There's a kind of, I mean, think about it. There's a kind of speech you use with your family, close friends. There's a kind of speech you use at work. There's a kind of speech you use at school. There's a kind of speech you use talking to strangers. Formal, informal situations. We all adjust. We're all, you know, we all master a whole bunch of different dialects and rhetorics and spin our language in different ways. So some people do that very skillfully, some people not quite as much aware of, you know, that they're in an environment where this doesn't play so well. So that's part of what we do with education, is sort of, when we talk about languages, make people aware of, you know, what the context calls for and how you negotiate your way through speech-wise, a particular context.
Let's talk with another caller. This is Champagne. Person is in Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have a couple things that I want to ask you about. One is something that David says a lot, all the time.
I'm in trouble.
No offense, but I'm just curious. When someone says, how are you, when he's talking to someone, and then he says, and yourself, instead of you and you, which I think I've never heard that except on, well, he does it a lot, and more people do, some people do it too, mostly on the radio. And
on the, radio.
The other one is using the word processes. Now, everybody around here seems to say that, and I don't know whether that's an academic kind of thing.
Instead of processes.
For processes. Mm-hmm. Processes seem to me a perfectly good word.
It is. It is a perfectly good word. And so is this an imitation of that sort of Greek plural axis, axes,
Mm-hmm.
Processes. Or it may simply be a sense that with so many S sounds, so many sibilants there, we need to stress the ending to make sure people we know we're saying plural, because processes, all those. You can sort of mumble it, and so processes is a way of of punching that plural.
Yeah, it seemed to me sort of like education.
Neurosis, neuroses, or is process. So you're saying that there's a kind of pretentiousness about it.
Yeah.
Okay, I could live with that.
No, the and yourself.
And yourself.
I just sort of cringe when I hear that, but
I'm sorry to be making you cringe. Never really thought much about it until
now. Yeah. Yeah, well, there is this sort of hyper-polite self that gets added, and it's usually in speech. So I guess I haven't heard that particular one, but I've seen self pop up in
it's not just David. It's in,
It's usually with the first person. I hear it a lot with the first person. Blank, 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 and myself
this. Yes.
Instead of and me. And that's a me avoidance, I think.
I think so, too.
I think we've been sort of conditioned to avoid me because
the
subject-object thing.
Right.
And do I say I? Do I say me? I say myself because that is invariable, subject or
but there's no problem with and you. Or
and yourself.
You don't have to.
I hear people say that now and then. I don't see that this, I don't know.
It's not.
How are you and yourself? How's yourself? I know, it's kind of an idiom.
Yeah. Okay.
Give him a break.
I'll give him a break.
He's been doing this even longer than I have.
I listen to him all the time, so I'm not.
Well, thanks. Well, I hope that there aren't too many cringes at per show.
No, cringe is a bad word.
Right.
Well, no, I understand. No, I understand what you're saying. And well,
people
have
visceral reactions to language. Yeah, they do.
It's true. It's true. And if I hear someone say something like Dennis and myself,
yeah,
that makes me cringe a little bit.
There you go. So we all make other people cringe.
I would try not to do that one. But how's yourself? I don't know where that comes from.
Okay.
It's just that folksy personality.
That's right.
This is on-air pose.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We have about 6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dennis Barron, and we have some of the callers. We will take as many as we can and talk next with someone in Champaign, and they're on line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question that I have noticed for the last 10 years and at least 5, I don't think I've even heard the past tense dived. I think dived is dead. What do you think?
Woo, dived is dead.
Even Garrison Keillor, in writing, says dove.
Does he?
Yes. And I've seen it in all kinds of currently written novels. I honestly do not believe I have seen or heard dived in 5 years.
Okay, we can figure that out quickly by doing a LexisNexis search to see if anybody's writing it in newspapers. I don't know. Is it dead? I haven't even occurred to me. I know that there's the dive dove variation, and it's interesting because modern English has a propensity to use the ED forms.
Yes,
rather than the
more difficult rather than easier.
So it's sort of counter to the usual pattern. Dove, dived. Is there anything that would make us avoid dived?
I don't know, the V and the D too close together?
I don't know why that would be a problem.
Isn't for me, but...
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know, I'll have to look into it. I hadn't noticed the death of dived.
Well, look into it and maybe you can make a report next time you run.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
So what you're saying is that we should say that
he
went over
into,
to the pool and dived in. Rather than saying he dove in. Like, to me, somehow dove, I just like the way that sounds better.
Does it? See, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me when I just think about it, and it's you don't get a good reaction when you are actually turning it over under the looking glass on the microscope here because it's a sort of an unnatural But it seems to me that dived is, I would say dived, it seems to me, but I might not.
Hmm.
Rather than dove. Dove seems odd. It's an odd little word.
Well, I don't
know. But I'm used to being wrong, so I'm sure I am this time too.
Well, how often, it's not that we're making the conscious choice, but how often do you think that word choice does have to do with has something to do with the way that it sounds to you, and does do you like
all right.
the
a
sound?
Lot, but you know how it sounds to you is probably conditioned by a lot of
depending on
things, you
what,
know,
what, like other, what people other people around say, you say.
Yeah, yes. And it sounds normal, abnormal, depending on what other people are saying, and so dove.
Hmm. All right, you think about that.
Okay.
All right. We will talk next with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello. Mm-hmm. I have a question about the word I. And last night, Senator Clinton, this is on the front page of the Tribune, right at the top of the page, and she says, the differences between Barack and I pale in comparison to the differences that we have with Republicans.
Right. The between you and I, between him and I.
And that's related to the myself thing that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Shouldn't it be between him and me?
Yeah, it should be because it's the object of the preposition between. However, usage in modern English seems to have turned between X and I into some kind of idiom.
Okay.
It's like a frozen expression. You wouldn't say... Well, maybe you would. You would find it less common to say between Barack and she, right?
You would think people
say between Barack and her.
Because you're talking about yourself.
Yeah, but when you're talking about yourself, now you know some people say that this is again is me avoidance.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that doesn't satisfy me as an explanation for that because it has become so fossilized as an idiom between you and I, between. Him and I. So, you know, I don't know. It just seems to have become an idiom. And we don't misuse the I, me in other kinds of, you know, preposition constructions, but it's that something about the between that's done it.
So do you correct it in students' essays if they'll use between you and I?
Sometimes, not often. Usually there's worse stuff that's going on that needs to be looked at, and, you know, I don't pay so much attention to that.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We will talk with one more caller here. This is someone in Iroquois County, and our line number two. Hello.
Yes, you talk about words that don't get used, and it's really not a word, and my wife always told me, she said, that's not a word, but since she's pointed that out to me, I hear the word a lot, and that's the word beans. You know, beans, your car's in Buckley, you know, I guess I'll go there too. And I hear it a lot now from people, and it just sticks out in my brain when people say it.
Huh. I never heard it before.
Do you hear that a lot?
I haven't heard it ever before. Beans, Mike. So it's like being as or being that.
Being that.
Being that. My car is being apostrophe S.
Beans.
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 Beans. I my guess is a sort of you know regional thing, you know, like you know, second person Ewens.
It's a very strange.
Which
word.
Is original, you know, y'all in the south, yous in some cities, yins.
Right. Yins.
Yeah. But if in this part of the country, like I've heard of WLL people calling on like the ag show, and
yes,
they'll say beans, you
yes,
know.
Beans, okay. Okay.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. That I don't think I've ever heard
I've
that
heard
myself,
it.
But maybe I'm not.
But the ironic thing, you know, people say, "Oh, yeah," that somebody uses it, and then somebody else says it's not a word, but they just use it as a word. So, you know, what constitutes wordness here? My concept of the word, or the fact that somebody, or apparently a large number of people, are using beans as a word. It's
and
a word.
If enough people
it
say
word.
It, it
what you,
becomes
what you're
a
saying when you say it's not a word.
You say,
you
I don't like this word.
Yes.
This word is incorrect. Yes. It is not in
that's
my
right. That's right. Not
dictionary.
In my personal, you know.
Okay. Yeah, all right. We are essentially at the point we must conclude
As a matter of fact,
the facts on the ground
say
that, actually about 30 seconds. Yeah. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave?
The Web of Language. Google it.
Oh, this is your blog, Web of Language. What sort of things are you
language in the
blogging
news.
About?
All kinds of commentaries on language in the news. The recent ones on new gender-neutral pronoun, yo, that seems to have sprung up on its own in Baltimore middle and high schools.
As a replacement for
he, she, it. Yeah. An interesting little phenomenon. Usually these are proposed by language reformers, but this one seems to have sprung up.
That's it, use that in a sentence
in
for
team
me.
Slang, you know, yo wants to, yo bent down to tie yo's shoelaces or something like that.
And why did they feel that
somebody observed teenagers using this and said, hey, this sounds like a gender neutral pronoun because it's being used for males and females.
I think that's interesting that they should feel the need of such a thing.
Yeah.
That they would be bothering with that. They wouldn't. Yeah. You know.
Right. Well, you know, sex is on their mind. They're young, hot-blooded kids.
Yeah. And on your blog,
just
people can call in, can write in if they have the kinds of questions that
there, you can reply.
Web of Language.
Web of Language. Google it.
Dennis Barron, he's professor of English here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Every once in a while, he's here. We talk about language. Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you very
Great
much.
Great to be here.
Particularly for spending all the time shoveling so that you could get here.
I've got more to do.